This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and welcome to Night School, the show that walks you through fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, this show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and frameworks the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week, we are joined by Petra Gimbat, activist, educator, scholar, and we're going to discuss the subaltern. Sharat, what does this work connote for you?
Well, having done a bit of cultural studies when I was at uni, of course, you know, you came across that famous essay by Gayatri Spivak. And it was part of a discourse, I think, that's both kind of Marxist and post-Marxist or post-structuralist. And then, because there's post-colonial theory. And of course, all these things might not mean very much to anybody who actually lives in the world. But it was, it seems, an attempt to understand the meaning of representation. And that was, in fact, in many ways, the abiding theme of cultural studies. You know, modes of representation seem to be what vexed, you know, theorists of cultural studies most. They were like, how do we understand how we represent the world, how the world is represented to us, and such. So yeah, so when you say subaltern, that comes to mind, that whole chunk of stuff. And then because the very definition of what subaltern is.
And because cultural studies has a progressive agenda, broadly speaking, the question always falls on representing the margins. How did you come to this topic, Petra?
I discovered Gayatri Spivak's article that we are kupassing today, Can the Subaltern Speak, a few years ago. And this was when I was doing my master's. And unfortunately, you know, at the time, you know, I was very new to theory. And as much as I loved what she had to say, you know, in her essay, there was very little capacity for me at the time to include her frameworks into the work that I was doing at the time, which was looking at street youth in Indonesia, primarily in Yogyakarta. So now I'm revisiting her work because I'm now looking at homeless communities in KL. And it seems to be quite a perfect, I think, you know, like an article to be looking at, or kind of a very good framework to be looking at, given that at the moment where we are in KL is that there's a lot of publicity being shone upon the homeless community. But, you know, at the same time, you know, when you actually examine the discourses, when you look at, well, who's actually defining who the homeless are, you know, like what they are, you know, are they good people? Are they bad people? Are they lazy? Are they not? It very much seems to me as if though we are not really hearing their voices, you know, and, you know, these kind of conversations are actually being carried out and dictated, you know, by people outside of the community. So it's been a real pleasure actually revisiting Spivak, you know, all over again to see, well, you know, like how does her article actually shed light, you know, on how we look at these voices. And it's been very insightful as well.
I mean, I found it bewildering when I first read it. I didn't think I understood it, not the first time, and after subsequent attempts at it, I really still don't know if I did. But what I did get from that discussion was that maybe the two ways in which we talk about representation, to represent, meaning to show again and to kind of construct again for as a form of reality, and the other, because it's to speak on behalf of, and to, so representation and representation, as it were.
And it's good also to note the context in which this was received. It was in the late 80s, 1988, and there were a lot of uneasiness with a dominant Marxist framework which prioritized a class perspective on what we understand to be the margins. And this essay by Spivak is largely recalled and appreciated for challenging that dominance and allowing for different ways of thinking about representation, namely the extent to which we can even claim to know what's outside the parameters of our lived experience, and how we sometimes, when we try to understand the margins, bring and import a lot of hegemonic assumptions into the discourse.
Petra, don't you think that, I mean, that on one hand you have Spivak's essay, which in some ways is a kind of critical response to the work of Ranjit Guha and that school of subaltern studies, that group of historians that were working on colonial texts and looking at rebellions and such. She didn't have a naive sense of of recovering the voice of the marginal or the underclass or whatever. I mean, especially because she was looking at an endeavor that was really kind of complex. I mean, this, of course, was people long dead in terms of in historical terms and trying to understand what their voice might be. So, yeah, in terms of trying translating that for kind of contemporary use, when you're looking at real people still living who can whose voices can be recorded, are you making too much of a leap?
So one of the courses that I'm teaching at the moment is a course on migration. And quite a few of my students are very much interested with it because of this or because of previous interest in working and with refugees, especially refugee children. And one of the questions that I keep raising with them, you know, again and again is, well, you know, when you think about it, you know, even if, say, you know, you've worked with the community for a long time, can you ever say that you're speaking with the community as opposed to speaking for the community? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I quite like bringing in certain theorists, my favorite theorists. That's the nice thing about being an educator, I think. You know, you have this audience, this captive audience, whether they want to be there or not, who have to listen to you waffle on and on about what you want to talk about. And Spivak was very appropriate in this kind of context, you know. So when we talked about Spivak and I was introducing the notion of the subaltern voice to them, essentially, you know, I explained to them, I said, well, the subaltern voice is basically a voice where even if, say, you give the person a mic and stand a person on a podium and that person talks about, you know, what his or her experiences or his or her, you know, rights, you know, essentially, you know, it's a voice that's still not being heard. And I gave them the more immediate example of, well, if you ask for an extension and I don't give it to you, it'll make you feel pretty subaltern. But, you know, I mean, more pertinently in relation to the article. So what stood out for me, and this was something that my students and I looked at, was that one of the examples that she gave, you know, of subalternity in her seminal article was that of Bhuvaneshwari Baduri. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. So she was a teenage girl who hanged herself when she was about 16 or 17 years old. And there were a lot of assumptions made as to, well, why was it, you know, that she committed suicide? So, you know, like people were assuming that perhaps it was because of a love affair, you know, that disappointed her. Perhaps, you know, she was pregnant. And then it came out that she was menstruating at the time, which confused everyone even more. And then much later on, what, you know, like came out, you know, was that this teenager who wasn't even 18 years old, she was actually part, you know, of, you know, an Indian resistance group. And she had been assigned, you know, a political assassination, basically. So after this happened, she realized that, well, you know, I can't do this. But on the other hand, I don't want, you know, to impact, you know, the work that my group is doing. So as, you know, like her way, you know, of taking charge, I suppose, she decided, you know, to, well, she decided, you know, to commit suicide. But, you know, what, you know, how I read this, okay, and this is where, you know, it becomes even more fascinating for me. So some of the analyses that I've read, okay, in relation to what she did, you know, they evaluate that, you know, she probably chose, you know, a time when she was menstruating, you know, as a last clue, you know, that was left behind to indicate to people, you know, that, look, I wasn't pregnant, it wasn't over a boy. But even then, you know, in examining that, you kind of like wonder, well, are we again, you know, like basically perpetuating, you know, her subaltern voice all over again? You know, are we making assumptions or are we not? So that's basically how, you know, I explain, you know, to my students, you know, like what a subaltern voice actually is, you know, like where you may have someone who is actually very self-possessed, you know, of her own intellect and her own decisions. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, because of whatever forces it is, you know, that's around her, you know, we are the ones who end up defining what her voice is, you know, and making all these assumptions about why she did what she did. So it's a very useful article to keep revisiting, especially within, you know, some of the teaching work that I do, especially now. I mean, given that quite a few of my students are interested in refugee issues.
This young woman came from a time very different from Spivak's, right?
Yeah, 1926.
Right. So again, we have the sense that the voice is lost in some ways to any kind of journalistic inquiry, to the kind of inquiry that, you know, you might have made if you spoke to the parents and you kind of like try to discover what her motivations were. Because we do that all the time, right? We do, in fact, try to reconstruct the motivations and thoughts of people, and we have many methods to do that. But what happens when this is somehow so deep in history that those methods in some ways fail, and all we are left with is fragments? And the question is, are we then left with this thing that we can say, well, we can't say, and we are silent before this wall that is history and time, you know?
Well, I mean, Sharad, what you just said, you know, I think it's really significant in terms of how we, whether you're in academia or whether you're not, you know, reflect upon how we criticize things. Because, I mean, what you see a lot of the time now, you know, happening, for instance, you know, like over Facebook, or, you know, when you see comments left, you know, on news articles, there's a huge outpouring of emotion, okay, whenever certain issues, you know, like come to the fore. But, you know, there's not a lot of self-reflexivity sometimes, I suppose, you know, which really impacts the way in which the issue might be understood, or how, you know, certain analyses, you know, could actually be pushed forward. And this winds up, you know, we wind up actually perpetuating, you know, like stereotypical arguments, you know, again and again, you know, which is quite problematic. But, I mean, more immediately, and this is also because I work quite closely, you know, with a couple of communities, I feel that even if you don't take a historical perspective, you know, to her article, you know, it still has a lot of impact and a lot of bearing, you know, on how you want to approach, you know, your own work. Because it's still very much possible for one, you know, to immerse oneself, you know, in a community on a near daily basis, you know, and still be very much, you know, of an outsider. And I think a lot of this also comes from my upbringing as an East Malaysian, you know, where my sister and I, we both write. We're both interested in, you know, like various issues, okay? But, you know, there were certain times when we were provided platforms to speak on certain issues, and we just felt that, well, I mean, given that, you know, we've been living away, you know, from, you know, certain parts of Sabah for so long, or been away from East Malaysia for so long, you know, again, you know, does this mean that we are speaking for the community rather than with the community? So you're very much aware of that.
I wonder the extent to which the same concerns that we have towards a representation of the marginalized can be applied to pretty much everything in language, right? Because this was inspired by a Derridean, a particular Derridean take on representation, which emphasizes the gaps between what's linguistically representable and what is actually there. Clearly, you can say the same thing about the bourgeoisie. You know, it's very complex. We really can't capture it in an entirety. We got to always have a gap between, you know, us and the phenomena, or patriarchy, or misogyny. I mean, it makes representation difficult in general, not necessarily just for the margins.
But one of the things, you know, that I'm looking at the moment, and I promise not to mention so many scholars, so I won't mention his name unless you ask me to. You know, like basically, so one of the scholars I'm looking at the moment, what he suggests, you know, as a way of providing counter discourse, you know, is to also, you know, observe how people carry out, you know, their daily lives. So the main thing that I hopefully be working on, you know, this year, you know, will be looking at how homeless individuals, you know, earn, you know, their daily wages, especially in terms of the work, you know, that they're doing in the daytime. So, for instance, you know, some of the work that they might actually be doing would be to pick up, say, stuff, you know, that requires recycling, or picking up, you know, old, you know, like items, you know, that could be repaired or resold, or secondhand items, you know, that could be sold. And these are all activities that take place, you know, in the daytime. All right. Primarily, you know, the site that I'll be looking at, you know, is we call it the Pasar Karat, the Thieves Market, you know, which is in town. And, you know, when I discovered it, I thought, well, this is really, really interesting, you know, because at the moment where we are in terms of, you know, looking at the voices of the homeless community, they are quite an unorganized community, because, you know, I don't think, you know, we've even begun to conceptualize what community actually means for them. But, you know, at the same time, when you look at a lot of the news articles that are coming out, you know, on the community, the photographs tend to reflect that they're taken at night. You know, a lot of the articles tend, you know, to focus on, well, you know, like probably a lot of the work that they do is, again, at night, you know, and illegal. And here you have this thieves market, which people tell me have been around since at least the 1960s in living memory. Okay, maybe even, you know, like longer than that. That, you know, has that basically takes place, you know, during the daytime. So when you kind of look at that, you see that the community still doesn't have a lot of space to actually define, you know, itself or define certain issues, you know, for itself. But, you know, on the other hand, when you look at the practice of their everyday lives, you know, you see a different kind of potential there, you know, for a different kind of a discourse. So this is one of the things that I'm exploring at the moment.
Fascinating stuff. And we've covered quite a bit in the first half, difficulties of representation, the resources for counter discourse. You've been listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and that was Petra Gimba alongside Sharat Kutan. We're going to take a break for the first half of the show, and we'll be right back after this. You're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, alongside me, as usual, Sharat Kutan. And this week, we're featuring Petra Gimba, who's been sharing about her work on the subalterns, in particular, the homeless of KL. And this is tied to her teaching and research. And in the first half of the show, we talked about the difficulty or near impossibility of complete totalizing representations of the margins, but also ways out, because you talked about counter discourses, seeing how they struggle, how they try to create a narrative of their own that somehow escapes dominant perceptions of the homeless.
Precisely, what is this counter discourse about? I mean, in some sense, I think what the theory does try to do is, I mean, we're talking about now Spivak's critique of a particular way of recovering a voice that is lost. But you have the bourgeois narratives, right? And narratives are those larger frameworks that allow you to give meaning to things. In fact, many times people are read in terms of these larger narratives. Now, when the counter narrative would be, say, for instance, the Marxist one, right? And in which class struggle and these things approach.
Yes.
And so when you look at something like the colonial period in India and you look at peasant rebellions and all that, it's often read, as these Marxists would, read it in terms of that trajectory of history. The question with post-colonial theory is that, or the problem that post-colonial theory seems to pose is whether those universalizing narratives actually operate in the colonial context. And so can you use a Marxist framework and all that meaning, the tools, as you call it, the resources for counter-discourse with the colonial subject?
And this was Ranajit Guha's concern, because India is an agrarian society without the universal agent, the working class.
Yeah, and that agent actually, in some ways, is predicated on the development of that other super agent, which is the bourgeoisie. If you don't have a full bourgeoisie, a bourgeois revolution, how do you talk about a certain sort of class consciousness and such? So okay, so then you have that, and then we try to bring it to
Malaysia.
something like Minimi. And I think I really sympathize with, you know, I mean, any student of anthropology and, you know, sociology is struggling with the question of representing the subjects which they are studying, right? I mean, can you really speak for them? No matter how much, you know, a participant observation that you do, can you really represent their feelings and so or thoughts?
And just to append to that question is the complexity of the KL demographic. You know, what is the Kuala Lumpur demographic? It's just so rich in so many identities that's overlapping, interacting. You have a lot of linguistic class complexity. What are some of the complexities you're encountering?
I suppose one of the things that I'm hoping, you know, to discover as well, you know, how does the community who I will be interviewing actually view their kind of space? Because it's very close to Petaling Street, okay? And I discovered this really interesting article that talked about this discussion that went on, you know, in the 90s, where, you know, there was this possibility of renaming Petaling Street as Chinatown. And apparently the reason why the people who were occupying the area were so against the idea was because they felt that Chinatown, you know, is a name, you know, that's given, you know, to areas populated with Chinese in countries where they're seen to be the minority. And they didn't want to be affiliated, you know, with that kind of minority label. So that's the reason why apparently now, you know, when you go in and you see the big signboard, it doesn't actually say Chinatown, because people, you know, occupying the area, you know, actually objected so strongly. what I've seen very broadly in the thieves market is that, well, you know, you do have a few Chinese vendors there, but you also have people of different races there as well. So that'll be one of the things that I'll probably also be asking them, you know. I mean, in terms of your space, okay, like how do you define it, you know, and does your identity actually come in as well in relation to this space? Is it very much, you know, an ethnic identity, you know, that you are relating to this space? Is it possibly, you know, like class, you know, because obviously, I mean, this is sort of the much poorer cousin, right, you know, that's operating, mm-hmm. you know, very close, you know, to Petaling Street, and so on and so forth.
Well, why is it so difficult? Why not just call them lumpen and use that classical yes. Marxist notion? I mean, you know, so here they are, they're kind of at the margins, the very bottom of the working class. They have, because of the way they work, maybe in crime or not, they're really not going to, you know, form a union or do all those kinds of things that are expected of the working class in terms of developing a class identity. Why not just use that very simple notion of the lumpen proletariat? I mean, you know.
I suppose the main thing, so a friend of mine who's with Project Dialogue, he also does quite
shout
a
out
lot
to
of
Hussein.
Work. Yes, hello. So you know, we've been talking about Indonesia, all right, and how Indonesia has its own discourse in terms of how it understands its own street communities. And I mean, we've been wondering, well, you know, how do we actually do the same over here? And also, how do we do the same here, you know, in a way that, again, doesn't perpetuate, you know, that subaltern voice? Because, you know, we don't want it to be another one of those, all right, I come in, you know, with all these ideas, you know, and I'll tell you what rights are, and I'll tell you what the international definitions, you know, of homelessness, you know, like are or is. Which, I mean, it's still important, you know, to have that exchange of information. But given that, again, you know, I mean, our community is probably, you know, still very new, you know, to this whole possibility of being able to dictate, you know, who they are, you know, and what their issues are and what the solutions might be. I have a feeling it's going to take a very long time.
Wait, why not tell them? I mean, why not see that the vocabulary that's present, including the rights-based vocabulary that you mentioned and listed out just now, why can't that be liberating for a community that might not organically develop that vocabulary?
It's the same concern that people who work with women's groups I've spoken to have, in the sense that the example of the deferential wife who loves her place as a third wife of a polygamous marriage, we can listen to her story all we want, but fundamentally, if there is a project that is committed certain emancipatory goals, you must do a little bit of teaching. I don't know. I mean how
kind
do you
of like too shy. I mean, it's always we're obviously guilty for imperializing and, you know, forcing our agendas on the poor or the marginal.
And what does progress look like in this framework?
Well, I mean, you mentioned linguistics much earlier on, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, when you think about it, you know, how far some of us, you know, have come, you know, to intellectually understand different perspectives on certain issues that impact the marginalized. I mean, think about it. How many years did it take, you know, for some of us to get here? And even then, I'm sure that the humble people occupying the space that's BFM at the moment, you know, you feel that, you know, you're not even halfway there because we're that humble. But, you know, so you know, in comparison then, you know, and I think Hussein, I'm probably putting words in his mouth, but I think, you know, like he and I are both hopefully very aware of this. He probably more so than I am. Where, you know, fine, you know, I mean, you can have that exchange of ideas where you share with them, like, all right, these are the discourses, for instance, that are going on in, you know, the United States or in Indonesia. These are, like, the international legal definitions. But, you know, the time that's required to process that, you know, it's not something that can be done in, say, just a 45-minute, you know, discussion, okay, with the community, because they'll all have their individual experiences. They might all have their own, you know, perspectives, you know, on whether such definitions apply to them or not. And then going back, you know, to linguistics, something that, you know, I find actually is problematic again and again, not in terms of what the community is doing, but how it begins to be read, you know, by the rest of us, the bourgeois group, is that when I was doing work in Indonesia and I saw the same thing being done over here, when you talk to young street youth or young, you know, like homeless youth about, well, why is it you're homeless? A lot of them, you know, might say things like, I just want my freedom. And, you know, this means that even when you talk to activists, you talk to social workers, you talk to, you know, the authorities who very much want to work, you know, with this community, they end up, you know, just leaving, you know, this perception that, all right, you know, I mean, the street youth actually want this, you know, because they just said that, you know, they wanted their freedom. Not thinking about, well, but freedom is also contextual, like all things, you know. Mm-hmm, I mean, what freedom could mean, you know, I mean, for some of them, you know, could be that, you know, they came, you know, from certain family backgrounds, you know, that might have, you know, like had, you know, very abusive, they might have had very negative experiences, okay, you know, with, say, you know, family or the community that they were living in. And when they talk about freedom, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're not subject to violence as well, you know, now that they're homeless and they're living on the streets. But at least they have a certain amount of freedom, you know, that they didn't originally have. And I mean, and this is dangerous because, you know, when we just hear the word freedom and we straight away make that assumption like, oh, right, you know, they've got their freedom, they should be quite happy. We forget that, right, you know, but even that freedom, I mean, that freedom might also come, you know, with certain experiences of violence, you know, or different kinds of abuse, you know, when you're living in situations of vulnerability.
But how do you solve the problem now? You have on one hand a self-perception that might not be completely opaque to itself. Somebody says, I'm free, right? And you're saying, well, actually, you say that, but it's kind of like cast within or framed within something quite limited. And then you're also very suspicious of people from the outside coming and imposing their frameworks on this very community or individuals, more likely. So then what? So between the false understandings or partial understandings of the actors and the well-intentioned but imperializing agendas of the outsiders, where do you go?
I think it really boils down to two things for me, at least, you know, at the moment. And one is that it's very much experiential and it has to be sustainable. I mean, the work that you're doing. So you don't just do a touch and go where, you know, you go in once and then you come out, all right? Because that just means that, you know, you're not basically giving, you know, the community an opportunity to tell you more and understand them further. And I find that, I mean, when we say, you know, homeless community, it hides, you know, a whole myriad, you know, varieties, right? You know, Fuad just now mentioned how Kuala Lumpur, you know, is quite diverse. Communities are also quite diverse. So, you know, the homeless community in Brickfields might be very different, you know, in dynamic, okay, compared to, say, you know, the homeless community in Bukit Bintang. So I think that, you know, in order, you know, to move past some of our assumptions, you know, you need that long-term sustained engagement with the community. And that's what I mean by experience. But the other thing, and this is very personal as well, I think this is where self-reflexivity actually comes into play. So, you know, this is quite new to me, actually. But hopefully I'll get better with practicing this as time goes by. But, you know, I think that, you know, in addition to listening, you know, to the community, we also need to then take a step back and then ask ourselves, well, how are we listening, you know, to the community, you know? Because, again, going back to the example I gave just now, freedom could have two very different meanings, you know, for the two of us. But, and that is very much, you know, influenced by our own individual backgrounds. You don't even have to make that comparison between the homeless community and ourselves. I mean, even in our relationships, our friendships, okay, we are making linguistic assumptions, you know, all the time that are very much colored by previous, you know, experiences. So I think that, you know, the onus is also, you know, on us as well, you know, to actually think, well, I mean, I assume that, you know, I understand where this person is coming from, but is that really, you know, the case?
So you're speaking as a researcher here. When you say we in this, are you speaking a researcher? You make a distinction between a researcher and a social worker?
Anyone who wishes to talk about, you know, the community in a manner that might ultimately define the way in which we understand them or the way that we label them.
Spivak has this concept called strategic essentialism, very famous and largely unpacked for its problems, but I think it's helpful in that at this point we're clearly aware of the limits of language, right? What can we say at any given time, any given location? So homelessness, we talk about homelessness in KL, is different in Petaling Street than it is in Brickfields. And even within those communities, there are gender, age, professional gaps that makes it all the more complex for representation. So when we use these words, we must keep in mind the very contingency of their values and the fact that it is always being revised and being changed as the encounter happens. So ultimately, it's really just strategic descriptions more than ontological ones.
But I mean, the very notion of community, I mean, to what extent do these disparate groups of people with very different biographies, you know, of either abuse or displacement or, you know, whatever it is, constitute a community. I mean, you know, why would you even use the notion of community? Why not just talk about, you know, marginal individuals and then take it as a on a case-by-case basis? Because you can make the argument that in Bukit Bintang and Brickfields is different, but, you know, surely when you go to Brickfields, you'll find a whole range of trajectories.
At what point do these things stop being different and unique, but a common plight?
I think there's space for both, and I don't think we really have a choice, because, I mean, when you examine, you know, the communities, just as very much we examine the communities that we belong to, you see that, you know, having commonalities with others, you know, doesn't necessarily take away your individuality. I'm being very positive here. And, you know, again, you know, even if you share certain things, you know, in common with others, you know, you still have certain very unique differences. So, I mean, you were talking about strategic essentialism. So from a strategic point of view, I mean, there is value as well, you know, with certain individuals, you know, with common characteristics coming together as a community, especially for advocacy purposes. But at the same time, obviously, and this is a very human need, you know, I believe, you know, you don't want to essentialize them, you know, to the point where you fail to see how everyone is a unique, precious snowflake.
Oh dear. Yeah. How does these theories of representation help social workers who obviously view the situation not something merely to describe, but in fact as opportunities for intervention, right? I mean, a social worker or the state that backs them wants to change the situation, not merely as maybe an anthropologist might want to just understand.
Well, you mentioned post-colonial theory just now, and I mean, one of I can't remember who it was, you know, who was actually looking into this, but I remember talking through one of the concepts with a student last week, where if you look at a marginalized person only as oppressed, then there are just only so many options available to the person, right? Because the person is oppressed. But if you allow space as well, you know, for this person, you know, or this community, you know, to also have agency, then you start to see various other possibilities. And I mean, something that I try to do, not always successfully, but I try to do, you know, when I'm working, you know, with people, you know, who have had experiences, you know, of abuse, is not to label them as victims, you know, but to call them survivors instead. And it's not just because, well, you know, I want you to remember that you're a survivor and not a victim, but it's also a reminder to myself as well, you know, not to, you know, like see them only, you know, as hopeless, but also, you know, to appreciate, you know, the strengths, you know, that they've had, you know, in surviving this far.
And I think that's a very key component in policy that sometimes technocrats evade or they miss because they're all so geared towards certain numerical, quantifiable outcomes. But fundamentally, it is all about building relationships and creating greater understanding between communities. And I think to the extent that these theories can help empathize, can help build richer understandings, and I think they help.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate as I had done most of the show. You know, What more can you expect from the state? I mean, the state needs to deal with numbers. We're looking at, you know, populations, right? So the bureaucratic response is easy. It's a kind of a straw man, right? It's so easy to knock bureaucrats for always thinking about numbers. But when you're looking at transforming, you know, social patterns, I mean, we're looking at these broad categories. Of course, numbers are going to play a role, right? And I mean, do we get ourselves caught up in this whole thing where we say, oh, the state in some ways cannot adequately deal with, you know, with these problems because it refuses to see them as individuals?
We have to remember that a lot of the reception of subaltern studies and postcolonial theory in the West were by either largely white readership or a very privileged third world, a global South readership as well. Who can afford to go to the global centers to study Derrida and Foucault, you know, and spend their careers doing that. So sometimes I wonder too that there are these assumptions of privilege in insisting difference as the default orientation, when in fact there are commonalities. But sometimes we don't accentuate the commonalities because of the hypersensitivity or hyper-othering.
Yep. No, I mean, I actually agree with some of what you said because I like Marxist ideas, obviously, all right? You know, especially when it comes, you know, to looking at labor and the homeless community are very much impacted, you know, by a lack of enforcement when it comes to labor laws or their rights. But I mean, again, you know, I mean, if we structure everything, you know, within, you know, that class analysis, then aren't we also, and this could be a very ivory tower type argument, but aren't we also reinforcing the strengths, you know, that they are, you know, that are held, you know, by people or institutions who are higher up, you know, on the hierarchy? In relation to what Sharad just now asked, to be really fair to the authorities, they have been conducting profilings on the community. So meaning to say that, you know, they've actually been collecting very broad data, you know, as in why are you homeless, or, you know, like what ethnicity do you belong to, what gender, you know, and, you know, that sort of thing. You know, so there have been actually more than one profiling study, you know, being done, you know, in previous years, and there might be more, you know, in future. But, you know, obviously, if you are going to deal with an issue that's complex, you need more than one way, you know, of engaging with the issue. And something that I know that a lot of the groups, you know, who are working with the homeless are advocating for, you know, is to please hold, you know, a consultation. So, you know, what this basically means, and I think subalternity, again, for me personally, you know, like comes into this, is that, again, you know, like rather than a soup kitchen or an NGO speaking for the community, you know, how about the soup kitchen, you know, or the NGO facilitating, you know, a process where, you know, the authorities can actually speak directly to the community. And we're not saying that things are going to change overnight, but perhaps, you know, this could be one, you know, like step, you know, like towards a much more equal engagement between the two. Something I learned when I was in Indonesia.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I think we touched on a lot of stuff today, Sharad, but this is all the time we have for today, unfortunately. And what we typically do, Petra, is to recommend texts for people who might be interested in our discussion to look up.
I suppose just look up online, Gayatri Spivak, Can the Subaltern Speak? And I've actually written a article for The Sun as well, trying to contextualize some of what we talked about, you know, in relation, you know, to the homeless community. So that might be even less complex because I've not read Derrida, you know, all of him yet. I've only read some of him through Spivak and post-development theorists. Mm-hmm. So that might be an easier starting point, but it's not going to be entirely comprehensive.
Oh, that's fine. I mean, as a gateway to these questions, why not, Sharad? You have something to recommend?
Yeah. I think there's an excellent collection on Marxism and cultural theory that I'd recommend anybody. It's very old now because, you know, I was reading it in university, so that must be very old. It's called Marxism and the Interpretation of Culture, and one of the editors is Lawrence Grossberg. Really brings together a whole range of concerns that cultural Marxists have with these issues, and, you know, I'm trying to bring an understanding that will give nuance to how Marxism has approach many issues. And one of the best pieces in there is by Cornel West, and he provides a way of looking at the question of race as well as class in the context of in a context like America. And so, yeah, so that's a collection that you might want to pick out of the library and borrow for 2 weeks or more.
I have in mind an essay by a philosopher, Alison Jagger. It's called Globalizing Feminist Ethics. I think it's from 1998, so it's a bit dated. Well, it's the kind of alternative speed, I guess. It's a bit slightly more dated. But she...
So Das Kapital's even more dated. But you'd have us read that, wouldn't you?
She talks about some of the things we talk about today, but in analytic philosophy language. So not the French, but more the Anglo-American sensitivities to clarity. So so it's a different... It's not a linguistic consideration, more spatial, and more on the complexities of engagement, practical engagement. So that's easily downloadable via PDF as well. Do you tweet, Petra?
Yes.
And you are on?
Petra Gimbad.
Petra Gimbad.
GIMBAD.
And you can email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook. Just type BFM Night School at search space and you'll find us there. This has been, as usual, myself, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and Sharad Kutan, and we were joined today by Petra Gimbad, talked about all sorts of stuff from subalterns in India to the ones in brickfields. Thank you for tuning in. This has been Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.